Welcome to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast, where SearchHealthIT.com editors interview leading experts on IT strategies for healthcare leaders.
I'm Don Fluckinger, here with a couple of Health Information Exchange heavyweights. Lawrence Stuntz, Executive Director of the Massachusetts eHealth Institute, and Mickey Tripathi, CEO of the Massachusetts eHealth Collaborative. Thanks for joining us today, gentlemen.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So for listeners who might be unfamiliar with your respective organizations, why don't each of you briefly explain what you do, starting with Mickey.
Okay, delighted to. My organization, the Massachusetts eHealth Collaborative, is a nonprofit professional services firm that was founded in 2004 with the mission of facilitating the use of health information technology to improve healthcare. And we support provider organizations, payers, state government organizations such as the Massachusetts eHealth Institute, to help them with the strategies and implementation approaches to make the most effective and beneficial use of health information technology.
Thanks, Mickey. This is Lawrence Stuntz, and the Massachusetts eHealth Institute is a public agency responsible for promoting healthcare information technology adoption. We were founded by an act of the legislature in 2008, and today have three main operational programs. We are the regional extension center for the state. We process Medicaid EHR incentive payment applications for meaningful use. And what we'll talk mostly about today is the last mile program for the Health Information Exchange, where we're promoting adoption of the statewide Health Information Exchange, the Mass Highway, which is built and operated by the Executive Office of Human Services. And in our role as the last mile adoption organization, we've partnered with the eHealth Collaborative and Mickey's organization to help our team to make things a little bit more confusing for everybody, trying to figure out the difference between the two.
Well, so both of you are heavily steeped in the rollout of meaningful use among physicians and hospitals in your respective territories. How do you think that meaningful use stage two is going to advance health information exchange in the United States?
I guess I'll start from my perspective, on the Medicaid program where we help process meaningful use applications. One of the key aspects of providers qualifying for meaningful use stage two and remaining in the program after the first year is that they have to implement some form of health information exchange with both their patients as well as other providers. And here in Massachusetts, we're actually migrating and making the public health interfaces available on the statewide health information exchange. So we think, you know, the impetus to move to meaningful use stage two is really going to drive adoption of the statewide health information exchange, particularly because of the fact that the public health data and the public health registries are available on the highway, the Massachusetts highway.
Yes, this is Mickey. Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I think there are three, with meaningful use stage two, there are, you know, three dimensions in which it moves us one step closer to the goal of having, you know, sort of a ubiquitous health information exchange capability. And those three are: one, it not only requires the electronic transmission of information to support continuity of care. So if a patient goes from a primary care physician to a specialist, for example, it not only requires that a certain fraction of those encounters be accompanied by an electronic transmission of the medical information, but it requires that happen according to a specific transport standard. But importantly, it requires that it be electronic and requires that it happen according to a transport standard, which is just a very important step. Meaningful use stage one did not require electronic transport, let alone having it be according to a specific electronic transport standard. So that's one incremental step forward that stage two has. The second, as Lawrence has described, is public health. So it makes more of the, it requires certain public health transactions that were menu set in stage one. It makes those core, and it essentially says that those transactions have to happen for every legitimate public health reporting requirement for the particular case we're talking about. So whereas before it said, in stage one it said something like, you need to do X number or X percent. For stage two, it basically says when you're reporting to the to ELR, the Electronic Lab Reporting Public Health Registry, you're required to do it electronically according to a specific standard for all of the qualifying transactions. Again, that's another incremental step forward from where stage one was with respect to interoperability. And then the third dimension is in the patient engagement side, where there is a specific recommendation that says that patients have to have the ability to view, download, transmit their information via a patient portal or what have you. But importantly, in the transmit option, if they're going to offer that, it has to be done according to this direct transport standard. So again, they're not only requiring that the provider offer the option to the patient of sending something electronically, which is interoperability, but also requiring that if they're going to do that, they also have to do it according to a specific standard. So in multiple ways, it's moving us forward with respect to interoperability.
Yeah, so both of you are involved in building state health information exchanges. What are the biggest barriers to state HIE implementation, and how do you think those barriers are going to be solved so that HIEs can be sustainable?
So from my perspective, the biggest barrier is getting easy and seamless access from the data that's sitting in the EHR and having a well-developed workflow that means that that data can be exchanged outside of that EHR to other providers across, or health plans or hospitals or anybody who needs to see that data without needing to break out of the provider's common workflow and go and do something new. So one of the things we're concentrating on here in Massachusetts is building on-ramps from the EHRs onto the Mass Highway so that that transfer of information can be done without needing to disrupt the clinician workflow. I think if EHRs aren't willing to build in a common and easy-to-use workflow, it's really going to stagnate or stymie might be too big of, too gloomy, but it's going to really slow down the adoption of health information exchanges.
Yeah, so in terms of what are the barriers to state HIEs, how long is this podcast? Not sure your listeners are going to be willing to sit through the full list. No, I would say, when I absolutely agree with the excellent point that Lawrence just made. I think another one is, frankly, if we're just talking about just state HIEs for a second, so, that particular type of health information exchange, I think, one challenge is figuring out how to make that a, something that is valuable in the complete, a set of options out there for health information exchange that are available to individual providers, both large and small. So there are many, many ways that health information exchange can happen, with private, so-called private HIEs that are coming that, that different ATO organizations are building. You have vendors such as eClinicalWorks or Epic who are building their own interoperability capabilities. You have some national HIE companies like SureScripts, for example, that are offering nationwide HIE. And then, of course, we have the nationwide health exchange that's supported by HealthyWay. So there are a variety of ways that health information exchange can happen. And in Commonwealth, I know that's another one that is of great interest to people, which is a consortium of vendors who have gotten together to create interoperability across their systems. So the question for a state HIE is, how do they offer something that is going to be relevant to all the providers in the state as a complement to all of those other things, and that you're performing a valuable public function? Because you also get into the question of what's the appropriate role of government. You certainly don't want the government to be crowding out what you know would be offered in the private market could deliver value in the private market, but there is a legitimate public need to be served by a utility-like function that that can serve all providers, regardless of who they are, so that they at least have some option if they can't, they don't have the individual resources to create a rich set of functions on their own.
So, yeah, Mickey, you bring up the Commonwealth Health Alliance, which was announced at HIMSS, which puts five big EHR vendors in a boat rowing together for the sake of patient ID and managing consents, you know, supposedly. What's your take on Commonwealth's eventual impact on interoperability?
I'm happy to go first this time.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a terrific step for you know, for these five vendors to move forward with some type of capability to have more seamless integration across their systems. If you think about, interestingly, you know, as compared to other industries, you know, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon to look at healthcare in you know, sort of perspective. In other industries, it was usually the customers themselves who were the drivers of, you know, this kind of interoperability. So if you think about how it happened in the airline industry, for example, it was, you know, American Airlines, you know, who were pushing forward to create what's now, what then became Sabre and has now been used across the industry for airline booking and pricing. And in the banking industry, it was the customers themselves, it was large banks who were the ones who, you know, were first and foremost pushing this with demand, and then the vendors came along and did it. Because healthcare is so fragmented, it's kind of interesting that the vendors themselves are the ones who are coming forward, because there's no other, you know, large-scale organizations who are truly nationwide who have enough, you know, sort of market presence to be able to, you know, do this on their own. So that's just an interesting perspective, I think, on, you know, healthcare versus other industries. That said, I think it's a terrific development. I think we need to put it into perspective, which is, you know, a couple of things. One is that it's going to take some time, and, you know, by their own accounts, that's, you know, 18 to 24 months, I think, before they have even test systems fielded. So that just speaks to the complexity of this. And, you know, and it does leave open the question of, you know, what does that do with the other vendors? And, you know, is this something that's really, you know, sort of being put forward to move the industry forward in sort of a industry-wide, you know, altruistic kind of sense? Or is it really five vendors who are getting together to as a defense mechanism against, you know, the two large vendors who were not included in the collaboration, namely Epic and eClinicalWorks. My suspicion is that both factors are at play. I think it is absolutely true that there is an altruistic industry forward aspect to this that ought to be commended and is hopefully going to be beneficial for all of us.
Mm-hmm. I think just to follow on a little bit to that, the encouraging thing that I see about the Commonwealth is that I think there's the potential for those entities or those EHRs to really build data exchange into the physician workflow. You know, back to my point earlier about needing that kind of integration in order to really advance health information exchange. I think, you know, from my understanding of what their plans are, they're thinking about this not just as a mechanism for sending data out, but really having an updated workflow that allows providers and to really manage the health of their patients and make sure that they can follow up on issues where, you know, a patient may have been referred to another provider and so on. So they're really thinking a little bit past just the straight get the data from one place to another. So that's encouraging to me.
Tell me a little bit about the efforts, the movement right now to establish HIE governance at the federal level. Sort of explain it for CIOs who aren't familiar with what's going on right now, and sort of talk about its impact on how it will affect or help the creation of state HIEs.
So I think I'll defer. I mean, it's sort of interesting to me, and I'll Mickey, I know, has been involved with a lot of the federal conversations, so I'll allow him to follow up in more depth. But when last year, when ONC, the Office of the National Coordinator, put out a request for standards for sort of governance certification of HIEs, the industry pretty widely said, we're not ready for that. We think that the states are going to be better served to figure this out on their own, at least at some level. So ONC has retrenched a little bit and is saying, okay, well, what can we really focus on? And one of the key areas that I've heard about recently is on this issue of state-to-state or health information service provider, HISP to HISP communication, and what, you know, what needs to be in place in order to trust that data coming from, say, Massachusetts is, you know, can be sent to data to an organization in Texas, and so to speak. So I think that I've seen at least somewhat of a movement more towards some of those technical exchange rather than formal governance, you know, from the federal side, where the federal government is trying to encourage, all right, let's get this widespread data moving rather than individual state HIE governance. But Mickey, I'm sure you've got other aspects that you think that they're working on.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you just said, Lawrence. And you know, I think it was the governance RFI and the responses that was issued by ONC last year and the responses that they got, I think is, you know, quite commendable that ONC did take a step back and say, okay, maybe, you know, let's take the feedback from the market and rethink the approach here. And I think there's, you know, still an element of saying, well, let's incrementally figure out what is the right model here. If you think about, that the nationwide health information network, as it were, originally going all the way back to the first ONC coordinator, Dr. Braylor, there was a concept there that the nationwide network would be, the idea then was it was called a national network, and there was almost the idea that there would be a national network, perhaps founded on what we now think of as that the reference implementations of the e-health exchange, so what the Social Security Administration, the VA, and others participate in, and it being an actual, sort of physical network. I think as the, as David Blumenthal took over and, we had general industry sort of maturity in thinking about this, that started to transform into the concept of the nationwide network, but not being an actual network, but being so much as it was a set of standards and policies that through the common implementation and acceptance of a set of standards, of common standards and policies, that is what would constitute a nationwide network. And so I think what you're seeing now is, sort of a push forward incrementally into pieces that can help us define better what those are. And so in particular, there are two grants that have been let, one to Direct Trust to help to further flesh out and make operational the some of the issues that Lawrence was raising with respect to HISP to HISP trust, and to start to say, what is this idea of scalable trust? How do I think about a set of policies and standards that could be implemented to allow the Massachusetts state HIE to be able to broker a transaction from Mass General Hospital to an HIE in Texas to the Baylor Hospital that is participating in that HIE? How can we make that work in a way that doesn't require the federal government to create a top-down network literally connecting those, but actually have it be bottom-up based on a set of standards that the government helps facilitate, but are really about the market accepting that those are standards that are worthwhile and in their own interest to implement rather than being imposed from above. The other second important contract that's going to help facilitate that is a contract that was given to the New York eHealth Collaborative, who's been doing work through their interoperability work group to further refine standards for interoperability, and so they got a contract to help further refine the work that they're doing. I think it'll be interesting to see how that starts to mesh with what Commonwealth is doing to see if we can get that to a singular place with respect to interoperability standards that move beyond direct and into query-type transactions, which is, sort of the next part of interoperability that we need to make it, sort of what we're all hoping for.
Right, and considering all those complications that sort of stand between those two hospitals and in distant states exchanging information, there's also the side where there are so many disparate, patient protection and consumer protection laws in each state. So considering all of these complications, I will end on a high note, but I'd like each of you to comment on what makes you optimistic that, despite all these barriers and complications, that true national HIE will be an eventuality.
I guess from my perspective, if you every time you talk about this with a patient, they say, "I can't believe you're not already doing it." So that says to me that that everybody believes that their data, every patient believes that their data should be moving among their providers. So there are lots of concerns around the models where, you know, data sit in a repository and a provider might be able to query it, and patients are concerned, well, I'm not sure who would have access to that. But they're almost universal, as far as I can tell. Acceptance and encouragement and sort of excitement for data being sent from provider to, you know, from one provider, basically following the patient as they transition through the healthcare system. So to me, that says the patient, the public, already believes and knows that their data should follow them around. I think in every other industry that where data has become electronic and more accessible, consumers jump on that, and you know, more data. You know, you've seen growth in, you know, electronic banking as you know, as they got standards for the exchange of information from, you know, all the banks and from the credit card companies into like Quicken-like software. You know, consumers jump on that and adopt that. I think you'll see the same thing with personal health records. Once the data are easy to get out of the core provider systems, I think personal health records will start to take off. You're starting to see it with a lot of wellness apps. So I think the fact that patients believe that their data should follow them around is the most encouraging thing, because, you know, if you ask them, they'll say, yes, I do want you to send my data to the next provider of care.
I would absolutely agree with that, and also add that, you know, I think that healthcare in general has been seen, for a variety of reasons, as being, you know, an industry that isn't particularly sensitive to consumer demand, in this case, what patients do. And there's a variety of reasons for that, you know, some of them about culture, but some of them about, you know, the intervention of insurance that makes, you know, pricing, you know, sort of invisible to patients and all of that. So, you know, certainly the dimension that Lawrence raised, that patients start to expect this is one. But the other part is that, you know, I'm very optimistic because providers are the gateway, and they also are seeing that interoperability is a necessity for moving forward, not just because it's required by meaningful use and accountable care, but I think they're increasingly starting to see that it's just a standard of care, that they literally can't really practice medicine in good conscience without having this type of capability. And it's, you know, it's going to take time for that to get widely accepted across the market, but you're starting to see it more and more, which I think is, you know, really at the end of the day is the only thing that's going to drive this. You know, my perspective is that the reason we don't have true interoperability right now was a lack of demand, that providers weren't pounding the table requiring interoperability of their systems. They were requiring a whole bunch of other things of their EHR systems, but they weren't saying that interoperability is something that I demand and I'm not going to buy your system unless it has that. I think that's changed, and I think we'll start to see that the vendor community starts to respond to that. And, you know, both for in the vendor community as it relates to physicians, first and foremost, EHRs, but as Lawrence points out, we'll start to see more patient applications that start to essentially express the patient's demand for this kind of interoperability as well.
Well, from my point of view, as an observer, a reporter, and a patient, I hope you're right. This has been a great conversation to get today. Thanks a lot for your time, gentlemen.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Don, and thanks, Lawrence.
Thank you for listening to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast. For more information and resources about healthcare technology and electronic health records, please visit SearchHealthIT.com. Thank you.